At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place. By working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies, we keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
The gift of neuroplasticity is that we can consciously create a new level of mind. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child. Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, ahoy, my dear shit shows, is what I meant to say. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea, and I'm a little off my rocker today, more than usual, I think, so just be prepared. I'm about to lose a bunch of listeners, I think, by what I'm about to do. So I was just sitting here getting ready for episode. And do you guys just like make up songs in your head and sing them out loud? I do that. And this is just what came out of my mouth. And I don't know where this came from. I'm not quite sure how I feel about it yet. But here goes. This is where we talk about what to do when your life's fucked up. I don't know where this voice came from. I sound like I'm like from the 1920s. I don't know if I'm ever gonna do that again, but I live alone. My cat is deaf and I need someone to share these weird moments with. So I'm Andrea and I'm a total and complete shit show, especially today. This is where we talk about what to do when your life's fucked up from your childhood. We curse here, you've been warned. And yeah, I'm an acquired taste. And if you're into me, I think you're really going to enjoy your time here. And if I'm not for you, no worries. I'm not everyone's cup of tea. So today we are diving deep into a hot topic, something that people are really interested in, a lot of people are talking about, and that is using psychedelics therapeutically to treat trauma and other mental illness. And I am joined by Miles Katz. So he is the CEO and founder of Confluence Retreats, where he offers safe, legal, nature-immersed psilocybin retreats. This is in Ashland, Oregon. So Oregon is the first state that has legalized psilocybin, which is the chemical in magic mushrooms, for therapeutic use. So he offers 5-day group retreats or private 3-day retreats that include all your meals, transportation, accommodation, and all of the prep and integration support needed to facilitate a safe and effective retreat. And he has over 5 years of experience in legal psilocybin retreats. Prior to starting this venture, he co-founded the Synthesis Institute in 2018. So this was over in Amsterdam, which also facilitated psilocybin retreats. And I have had the opportunity to talk to him quite a bit. Other than the interview, we've probably spent about close to 2 hours chatting over Zoom. And this guy knows his shit. I can tell that he's in it for the right reason. And it seems like he's doing some pretty amazing healing work. I was thinking about when was the first time that I got exposed to this topic, this psychedelic for therapeutic use. And it was back in 2019. So this was about a year after hitting my adult child bottom and about a year into this journey of like trying to figure out what my greater purpose was. And I was considering going into the addiction field in some way. Like, do I want to try to get into the business side of it somehow? And my therapist actually was just, because she was very plugged in San Francisco in the Bay Area with just various treatment centers and individuals, and she was just kind of connecting me with various people, but she invited me to the Dr. David E. Smith Annual Symposium. So Dr. David E. Smith, he's like known as, you know, a national leader expert in addiction treatment. He founded the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic back in like, what was it, 1967. So I don't know if you've ever read the book Season of the Witch, which is about the history of San Francisco, but they talk about him in there and about him like going to revive like Janis Joplin and members of the dead. But so he has this annual symposium conference that is addiction related. And the topic for that particular year was on using psychedelics for treating addiction. I remember Rick Doblin, who's the head of MAPS. He was the keynote speaker there. And I was actually thinking about how at that conference, one of the people that my therapist introduced me to was this guy, Peter, who he had an outpatient. He ran a sober house. He did sober coaching and he did sober transport. And it would be like several years later that he would reach out to me about this woman that he was taking to a detox facility up in Marin County who was looking for sober coaching, but she was looking for somebody to specifically talk to her, work with her about like adult child issues. And he knew that that was my jam, that that's what I was, you know, that I'd gone to work with my therapist about. So he asked me, do you want to do this with her? And I said, yeah, of course. So I would drive up there every afternoon. And it was like, if I ever relapse, I'm going to this fucking detox, folks. It was like this beautiful house in San Rafael. It was just amazing. I would sit by the pool and work with this woman. She left. She did not stay sober. I kept hearing that she kept relapsing after that. Like, remember, she got a DUI and all these things. And I actually just reached out to her a couple months ago. I had her number. I found a picture of the two of us sitting by the pool from that time. She texted me back and she said that she is 2 years sober now. So that's amazing. But it was on my drive back one day from visiting with her when I was driving over the Golden Gate Bridge that the idea for the podcast came to me. So if I had not gone to this psychedelic symposium and had been introduced to this guy, Peter, by my therapist, who knows, I wouldn't be talking to you right now. So yeah, and so since then, you know, I keep hearing more and more about it. And the research is quite compelling. It still is very early. And I will say that a lot of the research has been focused on using psychedelics for treating like treatment resistant depression, treating like big T trauma, PTSD. So with like veterans on, you know, using it to treat alcohol use disorder. And again, I just want to specify that this is using psychedelics in a therapeutic setting, like psychedelic assisted therapy. I did find one particular study that related specifically to childhood trauma. Put the article that I found in the show notes. It was published in the Journal of Psychoactive Drugs. And the researchers found that the association between adverse childhood experiences and psychological distress was lower in participants who had used psilocybin in the past 3 months. There's a quote, it says, psilocybin and other psychedelics are believed to provide an opportunity for individuals to reprocess or reevaluate some of these early experiences, reopening in a way the critical period of social development. Researchers have developed various models to explain why psychedelics may reduce psychological distress from trauma, but first, it's important to understand what it does to the body. Psilocybin works primarily on serotonin receptors, which play a significant role in our mood and emotional regulation. Its interaction with the 5-HT2A receptor is thought to be primarily responsible for inducing the psychedelic experience. In that altered state of consciousness, any sense of rigidity and hierarchy is relaxed. This allows users to change negative beliefs in favor of ones that are better serving. Another concept is the helioscope effect, a nod to the instrument used to look at the sun without burning your eyes. In a normal state of consciousness, thinking about past traumas can be triggering or emotionally burning. Researchers say that psychedelics offer a sort of helioscope effect by allowing people to consider traumatic experiences without the associated triggers upsetting them. This may help people reprocess their trauma and lessen the associated psychological distress. However, he does offer a word of caution. People with histories of childhood adversity might be at risk for bad trips when using alone. Working with a psychedelic-assisted practitioner is recommended for safety and efficacy. And the other thing that I will say is that when it comes to like the thought leaders on all the topics that we talk about here, so like Bessel van der Kolk, Gabor Mate, or as we like to call him here, Gaber Matey, Dick Schwartz, who is the creator of IFS, you know, they all seem to really support the use of psychedelics in the therapeutic process. They have all seen this as a very effective tool to use. So again, it's still very early research in all of this stuff, but everything looks very promising. And I can say that there are several members within the shit show community that have used psychedelics in a therapeutic way and have received great benefit from that. There actually is a subgroup, like a discussion board within the shit show app that is dedicated to discussing this psychedelics. What is it called? Psychedelics and shit. People that are using psychedelics in a therapeutic way. So yeah, I'm really excited for you guys to hear this conversation. And this definitely will be something that we'll talk a lot more about throughout the podcast. So let's get the damn show on the road, okay? But first, let's talk about why you, yes, you need to damn the Join Shit Show. That is my online support community where I host 4 weekly Zoom support groups where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal and having a little fun while doing so. We have a lot of fun in this community. I just mentioned that there's the subgroup for psychedelics. I did just add 3 additional subcommunities at the request of members that I wanted to share with you. So we've created, there is now an IFS group, so an internal family systems subcommunity. We have a religious trauma subcommunity, and there is a dual diagnosis subcommunity. So for those that are, you know, suffering from various mental health disorders like bipolar. As I've mentioned before, there are a whole hell of a lot of other ones. Shit show parenting, childhood sexual abuse, divorce and separation, healing from narcissists, shit show dudes. You want it, we got it. And if we don't got it, I'll create it if you ask me to. So how about you damn the Join Shit Show already, okay? See the link in the bio to join next. Sign up for my newsletter, Shit Show Nation. You can find the link to that as well in the show notes. Man, my tongue is tied today, folks. Give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at Adult Child Pod. And last but not least, give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple, on Spotify. Thanks. Love you all. All right, y'all. Well, I'm super excited. We're in for a damn treat. This is a topic that I was just thinking about how little I knew about this and still how little I know about it, but just through this podcast, learning about all this amazing healing and benefits of psychedelic medicine. And so we have the founder of Confluence Retreats, Miles Katz, in Oregon. Or did you play Oregon Trail when you were a kid?
I didn't, unfortunately. No. I think I'm a little bit too young for that one.
Really? How old are you?
36.
I'm 35. No, we had Oregon Trail. Yeah, and they would always die of like that. You'd cross the river, all your oxen would die.
Yeah. Like... Well, it's still daily life here, so I'm living it.
Did you ever play like Roller Coaster Tycoon?
Yeah.
Oh, that was the shit in The Sims.
Yeah. I was more of a Mario Kart guy, but I can hang with The Sims.
N64 was the shit. Well, so this is where I want to start is, maybe it's twofold. Like, what was your very first experience with psychedelics? And then was there one experience in particular that really pushed you to be like, this is something I want to like dedicate like my life to? Was there a moment where you're like, this is part of my purpose?
Yeah. Cool. I love that question. I'm just smiling, thinking about all the ways I could answer that.
very first experience? Was it in Africa for the first time, or had you dabbled before you went over there as a kid?
Yeah, so I didn't dabble. I was very close friends with alcohol starting from the age of 15. And I slowly developed a relationship with cannabis in my early to mid 20s. And I moved to Kenya around that time as well, early to mid 20s, and lived in a pretty remote village, 3 hours from the closest city, to work with a startup.
What was the backstory of that? I know you shared that with me before, but how did you end up getting there?
I was always a very entrepreneurial focused individual my whole life. I was raised in a small family business, and I had a very inspirational professor in college who introduced me to the idea of what we call social entrepreneurship, which is using the principles of business to produce some type of social or environmental good. And he was really focused on how business concepts could be used to improve the lives of people at the base of the economic pyramid. And so, yeah, I was like inspired to travel the world and go to developing countries. And eventually, shortly after college, I sought out opportunities to go live in Africa. I had this awareness, like, if I don't do it now, I'm never going to do it. And I was like, you know, I didn't have any ties holding me back. I mean, in hindsight, I was doing a lot of running away from childhood trauma in addition to pursuing like a pretty interesting career path. But I was like running away from challenging family dynamics and, you know, frustrations with that. And so, yeah, anyway, I ended up in Kenya technically on a 6 month internship that I knew I wanted to turn into a longer commitment. And it turned into a 6 year commitment where, and this goes into the story of how I started to dabble with other substances, is around year 4 or 5, I didn't really know what I was doing there anymore. The business wasn't going particularly well, but I definitely knew I didn't want to go back home to the US. And so in hindsight, I can see I was like entering a pretty deep depression phase. And in that phase, I just became more open to trying things. And so, you know, it wasn't the very first experience I had with any psychedelic that was the most transformational. I did have, like, over the course of probably 18 months to 2 years, I probably tried 2 or 3 different things I was told was ecstasy. In hindsight, probably wasn't actually real, and some mix of
speed. This was in Kenya?
Yeah. So my initial exploration was very unintentional and probably not very safe in hindsight. Nothing bad ever happened, thankfully, but the experience I had that really shifted everything for me was, it was like part of this tiptoeing and looking for like what would help me feel good, is I followed a group of friends to something called Africa Burn, which is a regional Burning Man equivalent festival in South Africa. 10,000 people, so still quite big, not as big as the original Burning Man. And it was here, just before I went on this trip, I had seen the research that had come out about what the brain image scans of people on LSD look like. And I had never touched like what I would have called at that time a hallucinogen. But I remember even being a teenager, my friends were trying mushrooms and being curious about what that could be like. Just from a visual standpoint, I had no idea about anything else. So these brain scans came out from the Imperial College of London. And I was like, gotta try LSD. Like, that looks way too interesting. It's because, like, I don't know if you guys, anyone has ever seen this, but generally, there are many regions of our brain that don't talk and don't connect. And this was the first brain scan on psychedelics ever. And they just showed all these areas lighting up in ways that they normally don't communicate. And it was just really interesting. And so,
what year was that, like, new research that had come out, just like when you?
I believe it came out literally months before that. It was early 2016. So maybe it was late 2015. Yeah. So I had an LSD trip at the regional Burning Man festival, and I don't think I'd ever like really enjoyed myself that much ever. Like, I remember wandering through the desert. The world felt like it was kind of, it was almost like I felt like I could walk over the curvature of the earth, even though obviously that's not like really the perception, and I was just laughing a lot. But the main insight I had on this journey was, if this is an experience that exists, then why does anyone drink alcohol? Like, and I just remember that. And now, like, many years later, lots of therapists later, like, obviously more psychedelics later, I can say that I was a very high functioning alcoholic and I used alcohol to have fun. So I wasn't the type of drinker who got sad or angry or broke things. Like, I just really let loose when I drank. And so I can see that insight is really key in my journey to not have an addiction to alcohol anymore, because I was using it to have fun. And like, it started out by like using psychedelics to have fun. And
well, that's what I was just about to say, is like making that statement. Like, what would we say if you were telling that story and somebody was like, I went to Burning Man and I used fentanyl for the first time. And I thought to myself, why would anyone drink alcohol?
Well, and then this is part of the journey, is like, and a question philosophically, like, is anything inherently good or bad? I would say no. Like, fentanyl, you know, I don't know a ton about fentanyl, so it's not fair to talk too much about it, but it is a medication. It is prescribed for things. Mm-hmm. It is, you know, so like there are uses for it. There are just way more and way more publicized misuses for it. So, you know, like that insight. So, and it's important to say, like, that insight on that journey was very specific for me and my healing. And it wasn't like just one journey, all of a sudden I'm cured of everything. You know, it's like, but my, it did really shift things. Like, I quite literally lost my interest in drinking alcohol overnight. And I didn't stop drinking immediately, but I lost my interest. And the journey I had with that is like over the next 3 to 6 months, like I wasn't doing any intermittent drinking. Like I was usually drinking 2 or 3 nights a week, but I'd still drink when I went to a social gathering or party, you know, every 1 or 2 months. But because I didn't have the intermittent drinking, I would drink the same volume that I used to drink. But my tolerance was very different.
And you started blacking out.
And like, especially in a place like Kenya, where it's generally not safe to do certain things after dark. And like, there's one time I woke up and I'd walk in like across town at night, which like really is a big no-no when you live in a place like that. And I just wasn't comfortable or proud of myself. So that those types of experiences happened a few times, and that kind of just led me to kind of like not really want to drink anymore. And I'd say the other thing that like really from that first big opening journey was I like my shoulders and my head were literally tingling for months. And I was hugging people more. Like, I was generally not someone who was very open to stuff like that. And people were reflecting that back to me. And I was nervous. I like literally started my journey into intentional psychedelics by researching whether or not I had melted my brain with that experience, because it wasn't as known at the time how safe they are. And I'm grateful that there was, it was like the beginning of this research renaissance. So there was enough research that I could find it if I was looking for it online. But yeah, I just started exploring like what happened to me, and like, oh, not only is it physiologically some of the safest substances we know about, but other people have these therapeutic outcomes, and there's whole forums online of people sharing best practices of how to do it safely. So, but I was 28, so I was like still very cautious. I'd had a long time of being indoctrinated of these things are bad, they'll ruin your life. So it was about 6 months of like really reading everything I could read and listening to. At that time, there's only a handful of books and audiobooks about this topic. But I eventually got to a place 6 months later where I was like, I want to try it again. And I didn't want to do it like at a nightclub or like kind of more the traditional ways people were using psychedelics and drugs in that scene in Nairobi, Kenya. And I was like, I got to this place where I was like, oh, I can just organize my own safe, supported setting to do this. And so I called a couple of friends and made a weekend retreat out of it. We rented a cabin in the woods. We had a friend who was going to come and just be the sober sitter, like in case someone, you know, had a, you know, an anxiety attack or something. And this goes into the other, this is the first, your second part of your question about like the most, the impactful piece is like, so this next setting was just a group of 10 friends in a cabin. Two of us were going to be doing it for the second time, and everyone else was a first time person. And so I felt like really responsible for everyone, especially like my friends later called me drug dad because of like how much I, in a, like in a normal setting, people are just like, here, take this thing, you know? And I was like, read this. And like, you know, like checking in with everyone. And
how were you like for sure that what you were getting was legit and safe?
That time, I'm trying to remember. At that time, I probably wasn't, you know, at that time, like the best I was doing was like trying to find someone I trusted who had a trusted source. I don't really believe in that system anymore. Like, There are many very easy ways nowadays to buy like $10 to $15 test kits online that will tell you if it's real or not. They don't tell you how potent it is, but they'll tell you if you have like, you know, speed versus MDMA or something. So that's what I do these days. But back then,
it was being produced in Kenya or was coming from elsewhere?
No, a lot of it's produced in Amsterdam and Europe.
Okay.
And shipped around. Something like LSD is really easy to ship because it's like a colorless, odorless liquid that gets dropped on paper. So yeah, there's a whole other discussion about like purity and quality. But this stuff I think was pretty close to it, still looking back, and came from a source that we felt trusted enough, you know, like, so second experience ever. I feel very responsible for this group of 10 people who are mostly very new. And I'm like really in my head about it. Cause like, you know, I don't know enough about how, like all the things that could go wrong or how to support people, but I did make a safe space. And I don't think I'd ever laugh. Still to this day, I'm not sure I've ever laughed as much as I did on that trip. And just like close group of friends. And so very far from what I do now, which is like a very therapeutic inward container, but just a lot of fun. And I had a similar, really powerful single insight on this journey where I was like out looking at the sunset over the savannah. And I had this feeling like at once I knew everything there was to know in the universe. And at the same time, I knew absolutely nothing. And I don't even really know how to describe how that brought so much peace, like, but it just felt somehow very cathartic and like, I don't know, like awe producing. And I still remember like that view very vividly right now as I talk to you about it. And, you know, everyone had a great experience. Like after this, I'm very close to my grandma. So maybe we'll talk a little bit more about it, but my mom passed away when I was younger. That's how I started my journey with alcohol. And I became very close with her mom, my grandma. And I remember like, I was so strong about my feelings about LSD that like, I had to tell my grandma like right away after it. And so I'm like, didn't know how this was going to go, but it's very insightful what she said back to me when I was telling her about it. Is I just told her how much I laughed, and she's like, "Well, this might give you a sense of who my grandma is." She's like, "Well, there's something really therapeutic about laughing," and I was like, "Oh yeah, like there is." And like, you know, like my friend today, who was the sitter on that journey, will still tell me how I was like cartoon slapping my leg laughter. And yeah, like when do I ever get to do that, especially back then when I was like coming out of a deep depression. But so yeah, that was really inspirational. Like not only like, oh, did I have a second really positive experience, but in some ways I had brought, you know, 8 people along for the ride and helped them feel safe and everyone enjoyed it. And so that started, you know, like a journey over the next 2 or 3 years when I still lived in Africa. We'd organize groups like this every 2-ish, 3-ish months and generally, you know, introduce a handful of people. Some people would come back and yeah, they got a little bit more intentional as I learned and grew and learned more. Like I always reflect that I didn't really have a mentor in this space. A lot of people will have someone that has a training or a wisdom knowledge. And like, I mostly was just like using the internet, but as I learned more and explored more, and even like there's some of this was still going on after I started my formal psychedelic retreat business in Amsterdam in 2018, like I was bringing those elements back and things like wearing an eye mask. So eventually we'd have like 20 to 25 people and we'd have one cabin that was like, if you want to wear the eye mask and go inward. And another one was like, just hang out and be silly in the woods. So yeah, I still miss those days. But that was kind of like how I learned and got into psychedelics. Still was like at this stage, like I'd say mostly in the realm of relief of negative feelings. And then as I grew into it, and I'll stop to let you decide where we take this conversation. But within the next couple of years after that, got into the world of like, oh, not only can these help you just relieve symptoms of things like depression, but you can actually lean into the, I would call it like leaning into the neuroplasticity that comes after these experiences, the mental flexibility. And then you can dig deeper into more therapeutic work that is often harder to reach. So I worked with many different therapists. I did, you know, EMDR type stuff. And that's when like, I'd say it's pretty unique in my knowledge of working with, you know, or being not directly working with, but helping over 1,000 people experience psychedelics through my multiple ventures. I'd say I feel pretty unique that I didn't have anything about childhood trauma ever directly come up on my journeys. But through the neuroplasticity and all the therapy that I've done afterwards, including still today, and covering a lot of stuff, a lot of layers. And I credit the psychedelics with giving me the open-mindedness to go down those roads.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, two things. So one, I think it's interesting, like the comment that I touched upon earlier about like, why would anyone drink alcohol? It's like hearing you say then that, you know, that it was like another 6 months before you did it again. Like granted, I know that psychedelics are not like physically addictive, but I could think that for, well, and maybe not, but you know, like if somebody is looking for something to check out with, one listening to this right now would probably think like hearing that statement that like somebody would then want to like, I got to do that again. And I got to do it again now. And so like, was there like a kind of a different feeling around that versus like, you know, probably the relief that you had, like, I'm sure when you started to drink and when you started to smoke weed, there probably wasn't like a, oh, I'm going to like take 6 months to like think about it.
No, there probably was
much more of like a compulsivity of, I got to do this again. Like, and I got to do this all the time and as much as I possibly can.
Yeah. And I'll say I these days with alcohol, I'll have a maybe one or two beers a month socially. Mm-hmm. Like it's pretty rare. Probably once or twice a week with cannabis, but I still find it somewhat challenging with that substance to know whether I'm in the space of like an intentional decision to use or numbing a little bit. Mm-hmm. It's like not as severe as it used to be with alcohol. But I think like the first thing I'll share on that question is psychedelics are not, they don't create physical dependencies like some other substances do. Yeah. Even down to the point that psychedelics like mushrooms or LSD, the way they process in your system, it's quite impossible, maybe a strong word, but it's quite impossible to become physically addicted because you need to give your body a couple days at least between journeys or else it won't have any effect. And mm-hmm. you literally will start compounding doses and it's not unsafe, but you won't really have experiences at a certain point.
Uh-huh.
So what I think the risk is, and I've, you know, I wouldn't say at that time this is where I was at, but I have been through periods of time where like I'm questioning the intentionality of my use. But the risk per se, air quotes on risk, is you are using it to not be present mm-hmm. with your life. And that's mm-hmm. I believe that's a decision everyone has to make. Like I still mm-hmm. do go to Burning Man. I still do have times with friends and I still do the inward eye mask therapeutic journeys. And I really believe that like there's no wrong way and there's no, well, wrong outside of physical safety, or I don't believe there's a wrong way. I have had very powerful experiences socially with friends on a dance floor and, you know, you're doing it the way that psychedelic therapy is being promoted these days. So I think it's really up for someone to decide. And I think I don't draw a hard line of like black or white. This is the right way to do it. This is the wrong way to do it. And mm-hmm. if you do it the wrong way once, you're a bad person. It's like, it's part of the learning. But there is, most people would say there's a inherent kind of like profundity or wow factor of a very high dose experience that most people don't want to go back into that right immediately. Mm-hmm. A lot of people like to take time to integrate. And it's definitely best practice, like therapeutic best practice is like, I would tell my clients like 3 to 4 months at a minimum, probably more like 6 to 8. And the clinical research shows that the effects tend to last for 6 to 8 months. And I would suggest people really lean in during like the 3 to 6 month window after a high dose experience to that neuroplasticity, whether or not they had profound insights about trauma they want to resolve in the journey itself. You can still use the benefits of the neuroplasticity to make shifts in your life that will lead to longer term change. And I tell clients that, you can tell by the way I'm sharing stories, like I have no judgment about how frequent or how people use psychedelics. Yeah. My desire for them is to not want to come back in 6 months because they feel like they have to come back because they started feeling depressed or, you know, started having other things again. My wish for them is that they choose to come back to explore deeper because it's a powerful tool and it can be used that way. And again, that's like also just a nuance of, you know, someone's individual journey and experience. But I try to do that framing and I'm leaning in more as I work with people to this idea that there's a nature of our modern society, particularly around therapy and talk therapy, that keeps us in the past. And the more we talk about these things, the traumatic events, our childhoods, like there's obviously a huge therapeutic benefit to doing it. And also there may be a stage where it keeps us stuck in it. So how do we start talking and thinking about the positive future that we want? And I'm borrowing this from someone that I was at a workshop with recently, but she was sharing that she talks to her clients about before the journeys, what's the last story that you want to tell yourself about yourself? And there's no pressure that it has to be now. You tell it as much as you need to tell it to get it out. And then at a certain point, you want to stop telling yourself mm-hmm. that story about who you are or why you're the way you are. And then post journey work, the question is, what's the story that you want to start telling yourself about your future self? And I like that orientation because it feels more, a little more empowering to me. And yeah, I agree. Like, I've gotten huge value from all therapies. I'm still doing it. And I also believe in the power of positive manifestation and forward looking. So
when I know that, you know, they were doing research in the US, like in this, like, what was it? The 60s is when they cut it off.
Yep.
So it's not early 70s.
Late 60s, early 70s.
Were at that point in time, was there research being done in other parts of the world?
It's a good question. Yes. The answer is definitely yes. I'm not as familiar with it. You know, at this stage, like, the war on drugs is pretty well documented about how, like, it was used as a political tool to suppress certain populations that were like, you know, basically like Black people. Hippies who were against the war. And then how, I'm trying to remember his name. There's like one guy who worked and started he basically like was a US representative who went on the global stage and convinced the whole world to criminalize drugs the same way the US did.
You know, it was really interesting. Who was the, wasn't it one of the Kennedys or somebody that actually testified in support of it and was saying that it was helping his wife? Yeah, I remember reading that.
LSD. Yeah, I forgot which Kennedy. Yeah, when you dig into the story, it's very sad. Like, there, at least some of the books I read, one of them is called Chasing the Scream. It's a really good book about the history of addiction and the war on drugs. But
yeah, that is really, yeah, that is a good, I've read that too.
Yeah, it's
that's a, pretty old. Yeah, that's a good one. Mm-hmm.
He talks about how the person who is in charge of the US government's Department of Prohibition on alcohol, like, had no job after the US legalized alcohol. Mm-hmm. So he literally went out and found something to criminalize and villainize. And that was cannabis and all these fake stories at that time of like a teenager in Florida who chopped up his parents when he was high on cannabis. It's crazy. Like, no one who really smokes cannabis would believe that that's a thing that most people want to do when they get high. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so yeah. So I think like the answer is yes, there's definitely was global research, but it was all shut down pretty similarly. Psychedelics are, you know, one of the only class of compounds that have ever been banned from being researched, which is a crazy idea. Like, that they were, up until that point, as much as they were used recreationally, they were being used in studies for alcohol addiction. They were being used in couples therapy and other things. I mean, like, if you go back and read about some of that research, it's quite wild. Like, scientists believed that the main value of LSD was they basically believed that it induced a state of psychosis. So they thought that by inducing a state of psychosis, you could like proactively work with it more. They were just sitting with people who were on trips, you know, so very different world than we live in today. But thankfully, there were a small handful of people that carried the torch, like literally from that point in time up until the 90s when the first clinical trials were approved again. Mm-hmm. We're still in a phase where those substances are still classified as Schedule One, still. And what that means at a government level is that there's no medical benefit. And thus they're very hard to research. Cannabis is still in this classification. And so it is very, as much as there is a lot of research and hype around psychedelics and the research, it's just, it's very slow and very painful to get approval. So with the first medical approval federally of psychedelics, which should be in a couple of years, one of the main benefits, I think, will not just be like the treatment that it's approved for, which looks like it'll be treatment-resistant depression, but it'll force the government to reclassify the substance from Schedule One probably to 3 or 4, and that will just make research a lot easier. So we'll start to see this snowball effect on what's researched and how well it can be researched. So
can you share like what have been, I guess, pivot, like over the past, since they approved, like allowed research again back in the 90s, have there been some pretty pivotal markers or studies that came out that have ultimately led, for example, to having it become legal in Oregon and then like the decriminalization in other cities, like were there particular studies or like incidences that really drove this stuff?
Yeah, for sure. I can share a few. I'm not sure I'm going to hit like the exact most impactful ones, but there's definitely a handful that come to mind. And I'd say like across the board, what is generally very interesting is most modern treatments for mental health, including things like antidepressants, have about a 30% success rate, which when you really think about it is pretty wild. Like 30% of people have a benefit, 30% of people don't, and 30% of people feel worse. So the fact that that's like our go-to treatment option for something like depression is pretty scary.
Yeah.
Generally, as we've seen research on things like psilocybin, which is the active ingredient in mushrooms, or MDMA, which is very psychedelic, but some people will argue it's not a classic traditional psychedelic. But regardless, like across the research outcomes, what we're seeing is people who qualify for treatment resistant conditions, which means they've had, I don't know the exact definition, it's like 2 to 4 failed attempts at treating the condition over X period of years, will have remission of symptoms for 6 months after a single or 2 psychedelic journeys. And that's pretty wild just in the scheme of like what we have available for mental health, that a single dose of anything can be twice as effective of what the status quo is. And so that has led the government to, this is part of what the question you asked, is MDMA for PTSD and psilocybin for depression have been designated what's called breakthrough therapy status. So they're in the clinical trial phase and the FDA says, this is so good that we want to give it a fast track to approval. And so I think like that is one of the major milestones for both of those substances that has brought so much light and attention, is like not only the government, not only the results, but the government acknowledging that they're so good that, you know, we want to fast track the approval compared to a conventional approach. Say like some of the most interesting and impactful studies.
For those in particular, like with the effectiveness in your, would those be, because you said like a single use, but would that be used in a therapeutic setting? Like that wouldn't just be like somebody just does it on their own. Like it would be like kind of used in a therapeutic way, correct?
At Parker, our purpose is simple. We want to make the world a better place by working more efficiently, by using more sustainable practices, by developing better technologies. We keep moving forward. With each new idea, innovation, and partnership, we're one step closer to fulfilling our purpose every single day. To find out more, visit parker.com/purpose. Parker, engineering your success.
Yeah. Thank you for asking me that. Clarifying point is that all the clinical trials are done in a very therapeutic setting where the participants have at least 3 to 6 psychotherapy sessions before the journey and at least 3 to 6 after the journey. And during the journey in the clinical trials, there's 2 people with the person who's going through the journey. So it is incredibly supported and well held. And they're generally wearing an eye mask for their journey, which means, it's mostly so they can be purely in the journey with their subconscious and their subconscious thoughts. People can have very transformative experiences in nature or with their friends or at music festivals, but on some level, they're being distracted from what's in their subconscious. So the modern psychedelic therapy approach is to wear an eye mask and just be with your subconscious. And so, that is the foundation for all the clinical trials. It's the foundations for the legalization that has occurred in Oregon, and it's happening in Colorado very soon. And I assume that's going to be the foundation for this, you know, as this continues to be popular for the next wave. I don't envision that that's going to change very soon. So
I'm sure it varies, but like traditionally speaking, like the free trip, you know, sessions, therapeutic sessions, do you know if there's any like consistency in preparing study participants in doing that? Is it just varies person to person?
There's definitely best practices for preparing someone for a journey. And Johns Hopkins, who has done a lot of the research, came up with the term flight instructions.
Okay.
So it's like and they're published online, but it's like basically like how to prepare for your flight, your journey. And it's things like an education on how to navigate the experience. Like best practices are, you know, lean into resistance instead of resist it. A lot of what people consider bad trips is believed to be when something comes up in someone's experience and they try to resist it or fight it or say, I don't want to see that. You know, other just like, I think like given the context of how our society is coming to psychedelics, it is really important to spend a lot of time on like education and safety of like what different experiences you can have, how to navigate the challenging ones, what might happen in a session. So those are like pretty fundamental, I would say, in preparing people. And outside of that, I'd say there's probably just a range of ways people approach it. But I'd say at a general level, everyone is, if they're a skilled facilitator, I would say you're generally trying to help someone. Well, people generally come with an intention. That's like an important part of the process to name is like, and if a facilitator will help you kind of fine tune that, that's part of the preparation process. And I think of it as...
Are there any like do's and don'ts there?
I don't think so. I think like it sometimes can be difficult people to have an intention, but not an expectation. It's like, what's the difference between like, I really need this or want this to fix my XYZ condition versus like, I'd like to explore what's underneath my addictive behaviors, for example. So that can be something that can be tricky, particularly for people who are coming to psychedelics as like a quote, last resort, which is a result of our society not having other solutions and putting these solutions on the fringe still. But I'd say like a good facilitator will help you look around your intention and maybe try to dig a little bit underneath it, like what might be behind it, or help you frame it in a way of like, okay, like maybe you're suffering in this way, but how do you want to feel afterwards? Like what's available for you if you no longer feel this suffering, then what positive feelings can you have? So there's like some ways that facilitators help people with that. I tell people that I've been working with that I kind of look at it as like, let's use this time as preparation to look under the stones in our minds, and because we really don't know what's going to come up on the psychedelic journey. I do believe that like the more you focus on something, it does increase the likelihood that it could come up. But a lot of people will get different experiences, different lessons, and it doesn't mean they're less valuable or less powerful. But yeah, it's just important to name. So when I work with people, and this is borrowed from people that I learned from who are more experienced than I am, you know, the practice is let's do all this work to clarify your intention, see if we can uncover anything a little bit underneath the surface before the psychedelic takes us way underneath the surface. But right before we take the psychedelic, we let it go and we practice surrendering because we don't actually know if that's going to come up or how it might come up. And a big part of the journey, best practices are just being open to whatever happens. And so, yeah, so, but it's an important part of the process to prepare. Everyone has a reason they're coming to do a journey, you know, and yeah, I talked to some people who are,
do you have any like good examples of somebody to where like what that unfolding process looked like in figuring out the intention and kind of, yeah, maybe certain questions that you asked, or if they came to you and said like, this is what I want. And then versus to like where they ended up, like right before they actually did the journey. I'm just like curious if, you know, just to like see an example of, you know, what that process could potentially look like. And I'm sure that this is also why it's so important to do it with somebody who is, you know, has experience and is, and also like a third party, right? Somebody who can kind of like look at things like objectively. Cause I'm almost wondering, like, could it potentially be dangerous for somebody to like, I don't know, do that part all, I don't know. I'm just thinking maybe it's just really helpful to have somebody help you with that clarity to, I think the expectations part could be really a lot more at risk if you're kind of doing that part all on your own.
Yeah. Yeah. Really skilled facilitators will really, really be tactful in shifting that and grounding that. And, you know, like I can just share an example from my personal journey work. And this is like going back to pretty early in my journeys, as my previous organization in Europe was hosting one of its first retreats. We had a client cancel. So I wanted to jump in to do a test run as a client. And we had a really skilled facilitator named Natasha, who's very intuitive. And I can't even remember what I said. I was just telling her a little bit about my life. I wasn't a proper client, so I didn't have a full proper intention. But she just kind of stopped me in the middle of my sharing. And she said, you need to forgive your dad for what happened after your mom died. And I just like instantly stopped and started tearing up. And until that moment, that thought had never crossed my mind. And that ended up not coming up in the journey at all, but I definitely remembered it and it led me down this road I went on with therapy and other things. So there's just a lot of ways that skilled facilitators can support you in that beginning phase. Yeah, and I can share, like, that's a very unique example with someone who has very intuitive spiritual abilities, which, mm-hmm. you know, is probably less common, admittedly. And just share, like, some of the work we've done with our clients more recently. Like, it's not uncommon for people to come to me and be like, I'm just curious. I read about this. I heard about this. But, you know, I don't have a specific reason I want to try it. And so we work with them and we're like, okay, well, like, start to, like, use that metaphor of, like, looking under the stones. I'm like, okay, well, like, maybe you do a little bit of, like, not prodding, but like asking around, like, what's going on in life? Like, how are you feeling? How do you want to feel after this journey? Like, that's usually a question that gets people a little bit more in the mindset of, like, oh, okay, like, I can start to distill and, like, take this thing that just feels like my everyday life and a lot of noise and automations that are happening into, like, oh, there are specific parts. So, like, oh, there is this thing I've been carrying with my relationship with my mother who, you know, I'm not a child anymore, so I don't need to relate to it that way. Start to look at that. And yeah, like, I always tell people, like, the intention of this process is to, like, approach it with calmness and curiosity and courage. And if it feels like we're prodding into something or like we're making something that doesn't actually exist, probably not helpful in the scheme of things. But yeah, like, how do you support someone? It's always better if you can inspire someone to discover it for themselves, as opposed to, like, there are times where, like, if you do this work long enough, or, you know, you can see patterns people have, but if you tell someone what their pattern is.
Yeah. And they can't see it for themselves. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So the skill is trying to help them discover it for themselves and, you know, asking questions that might lead them to look at it in different ways themselves. And I'm always surprised very pleasantly. And, like, usually there's a certain layer that you get under and people just start opening up and talking mm-hmm. pretty easily because, you know, they're just not used to in this world having people that you relate to or talk to in this way. It's like our day-to-day lives generally are not like, let's go deep into, like, our feelings with people, even people we live with, right? Like, a lot of people don't feel comfortable talking to their spouses about certain feelings they're having. So just trying to create that safe of, like, really deep safety, like, trust, like, no judgment. Like, you know, like, I always tell people, like, I've been doing this for 5 or 6 years. Like, you're probably never going to say something that is surprising to me. And if you do, that's awesome, because that's an exciting new thing. You know, that's more my approach, is, like, I just want people to feel really safe psychologically, because that's so much of people having an experience, and particularly an initial experience. Or
is there ever an example where it'd be like, this is, like, an unhealthy intention to have?
I would say that I have declined to work with certain people who are just, like, really feeling like, I'm broken and I need this to fix me. So I'm not saying, like, it's not that psychedelics can't be helpful for people who are suffering to a certain degree, but there are definitely certain people who are better supported by maybe people who have experts in very specific types of trauma or specific mm-hmm. patterns. Or you can be more held one-on-one versus, like, I like to work with groups of people. And so, you know, is it an unhealthy or bad intention? No, but I think some people might require more support or more particular types of support to get to a space where someone might say they're ready. Because what are the risks there?
You know?
Yeah. I would say it's mostly just that, like, people really have a challenging experience because it is almost certainly not going to be what they expect, period, for everyone. But particularly if you have, like, that level of expectation. And there's this tendency as a result of how the media talks about psychedelics and emphasizes psychedelics that people come in with very big expectations. And I very much believe in them. I see people have these transformations all the time. But again, it's like this delicate dance of, like, expectations get in the way of outcomes sometimes. And so how do you hold that possibility with someone still while also lowering their expectations and creating, it's not even that, like, having a hope is bad or having a desired outcome is bad, but we generally don't know what the process between point A and point B is going to look like. And it might look like one journey, and it might look like multiple journeys, and it might look like rainbows and butterflies flying through the universe on your journey. And it might look like facing some really hard truths about your childhood that you haven't accepted. And so that's, like, the practice of, like, really surrendering to the experience and And sometimes I tell people, like, maybe you do know about this trauma that happened when you were younger, and maybe there is something big to resolve in it. And maybe now isn't the time for that for other reasons. You know, one client, and I can share this story because he shared it on a video testimonial, is a client who came in March with treatment-resistant depression on a five-day program, two journeys. And so we intentionally start with the lower journey on the first dosing day. And the second journey day is, of course, like somewhat built up because it's the kind of the climax of the whole five-day retreat. And in this journey, he said he, again, all with his eye mask on, so in his mind, he kind of peered around the corner and he saw, I can't remember the exact words, but he saw his demons, he says, like he saw the big scary trauma thing that he had come to resolve, and he didn't face it. But in that process of not facing it, he had this like realization and ultimately really big sense of peace that he doesn't have to face it right now. And he doesn't have to compare himself to other people and their healing journeys. And the mushrooms will always be there for him when he's ready to come back. And I just love that story because it's a great story of how it was like a really impactful experience for him. Like, he has repeatedly told me that that was like the most five impactful days of his life. And it was very far away from like the types of stories you read about where like big mystical oneness, everything is, you know, so yeah, these things work in mysterious ways. And most people, including myself, believe it's like just kind of like getting ready and just trusting the process to unfold the way it's supposed to unfold.
What do you feel like as far as approaching it from like a purely, like a purely like mental health, like going and doing it with a doctor, like with a therapist, versus when there is an added element of like spirituality? Like, do you see any differences there?
Yeah. It's an interesting question. So I didn't get to share this earlier, but one of the most interesting outcomes of clinical research, which happened at Johns Hopkins, was, and there's a couple of different studies that touch on this, so I'm not going to get the exact statistics right, but something in the magnitude of 80 to 90% of people in a clinical trial setting, which is like basically being in a doctor's office in a building, will quantify the meaningfulness and slash or the spiritual significance of their experience as one of the top three most meaningful experiences of their life. And that research was very catalytic to create a lot of interest around psychedelics. And so I do believe there is something intrinsically about these transcendental experiences that help us feel more connected. And there's lots of other research outside of that, like people feel more connected to nature, they feel more connected to other people. So I think those are elements of the experience anyway. So I think being in a setting and a surrounding where that can be supported and enhanced can inherently help bring those elements out. And I think this is something that our society doesn't generally do very well. Like, most people have disillusion, or else an increasing amount of people have disillusion with religion, mainstream monotheistic religion. And, you know, and there's a difference between spirituality and religion, and, you know, that's for everyone to go on their individual journeys to figure out. But generally, a sense of like connectedness and purpose and meaning is very helpful for therapeutic outcomes to unfold, for people to, you know, overcome things like addiction and depression. And so our approach is not to be prescriptive with any of that. We have some elements in our programs that are, you know, borderlining with what some people might consider very woo-woo things. And we just say, if it doesn't resonate, let it go. Like, our intention is just introducing concepts to people in case they do resonate. A lot of them do have roots, and like, they're not like out of the blue picking things that we like. They're like, they're traditions that have been borrowed from other lineages of how psychedelics have been used through the years. But I would say that it's likely going to happen anyway. And I think at a certain level, it's really hard to distinguish like what's therapeutic clinically and what's spiritually enhancing. And I have a lot of concerns about what the future of medical psychedelics may look like when it's prescribed by people in white coats and done in hospital rooms. And yeah, so I wouldn't put too much faith in that system. You know, hopefully a lot of people get relief, but there's nothing to say that a medical doctor will be a better psychedelic facilitator than anyone else.
You know, shit.
Yeah.
Based off your years and years of experience and running your business in Amsterdam and now doing this, what, through your experience, what you've seen, what you've experienced personally, what do you think is relevant for that you've learned or noticed or experienced that's like relevant for my audience, like those who are trying to heal from the impact of their childhood or also suffering from addiction, like at an active addiction? Like what, what do you think is important to note here?
It's very, very broad, like letting you take that however you want to take it.
Just yeah.
Throw that out there.
Yeah. It's an awesome question. I mean, I think like my main intention of reaching out to you and others that I've reached out to, not a ton of people, but so I've been on the forefront of legal psychedelics for the past 6 or 7 years, which is still a very nascent field or industry, however you want to say it. And I, as you have heard, I don't like, I have lots of experiences that don't follow the law, so, but I do really appreciate the sense of safety that a legal experience provides for someone. So my interest now is helping to educate people that there are legal, safe ways to try this. And so the first thing that comes to mind, like when you ask that question, is one, like, yeah, that, just that, like, so there are a number of countries you can go to for legal experiences, but Oregon now is the first place in the world ever where psilocybin mushrooms are not only legally available, but actively regulated by the state's health authority. So there's a licensing system to be a facilitator, to be a center where you can go to have your experience. The people who grow the mushrooms are licensed and regulated. So, you know, like at the end of the day, do I believe all that is required for people to explore psychedelics? Absolutely not. But it does provide a lot of safety and structure for a much larger audience to feel comfortable to come in. So that's possible. I think like also important to know, whether you come to Oregon or anywhere you might go, is the models that currently exist, in my opinion, are very far away from what might be considered an ideal model for how to use psychedelics. And it's not anyone's fault. It's like we live in a very complex society. Generally, our mental health care system is very broken. And so I know people are generally looking for a lot of different support, but I would very much always support that people have long-term therapists before and after their journeys, because journeys will continue to unpack themselves for many weeks, if not months, after the occurrence. So generally what you'll find in Oregon is people work with a facilitator. And this is common in underground settings as well. Like you might have 2 to 3 sessions on the high end, both before and after your journey. And that's okay. Like it's helpful, but it's not gonna resolve everything. And if you look closer at the clinical trial data for things like treatment resistant depression, they show that people tend to go back into depression around 6 to 8 months later. And so there's an orientation I'd like to share about what we're doing in the clinical trial's main purpose is to give someone a substance, in this case, a substance paired with some psychotherapy, and then sit back and watch and let it happen and measure what happens. That's like the whole point of the double blind trials, to prove that it works. In a real world implication, like I would never want to sit back with a client and see if it works for 6 months. So that's where I talked earlier about like really leaning into not only the fact that like the psychedelics can provide huge symptom relief immediately for a period of months, but I'd say almost more importantly, like for longer term benefit, is like leaning into like, now is the time to like use that. What neuroscience has shown is mental flexibility to make changes and shifts. And, you know, whether it's like changing your work or changing certain relationships or just healthier eating, like all these things become more easily available after a psychedelic experience because of the neuroplasticity that they produce. So that's like a soapbox I've been standing on lately. Like come to Oregon, go to Jamaica. If you want to try this, find a place that you feel safe and reputable, but don't lose sight that it's not like there's no one solution. Yeah.
Yeah. And when we say, well, first, have you found that it I mean, let's not say like somebody who's treatment resistant to depression, but like, have you found that for somebody who's had a lot of therapy over the years, that these experiences end up being more beneficial to them? Like, do you find that the level of work or self-awareness that one might have plays into how impactful the experience could be?
One of the immediate things that comes to mind when you ask that question is sometimes people are worse off depending on their therapist.
I was thinking that too. I was wondering if like, I could also,
yeah, I would, I would generally say yes. Like the more, because the term psychedelic means mind revealing. Mm-hmm. So I would say that the more you've attempted to do some of that inner work already and have some framing and tools to understand, like, I would definitely say like can be more impactful for an experience. You know, that comment about like sometimes people are worse off, that's like relatively probably a much smaller percentage of people. And a lot of people are just disillusioned with therapy because they've tried it for so long. A lot of people
even just therapy, but like have worked on their, like have attempted to work on themselves to some extent.
Yeah. And that for me, like gets into like the paradigm of like, not only like treatment diagnosis, which there's a lot of benefits for psychedelics in that paradigm, but what I call from functioning to flourishing. So people like already doing things that fall into personal growth or mindfulness or, you know, and it's not necessarily like flourishing, making a bunch of money, flourishing, like feeling good, like living with purpose, having healthy relationships, having healthy habits. And I think psychedelics are super powerful tools for that. And so, yes, like any of these things, like I love when I talk to prospect clients and they've already experimented with meditating or they, you know, try yoga, and like that just shows to me that they're already on this journey. Like, and the same client I mentioned earlier, I shared his personal story for March. Like his outcome of his retreat with us was that life, it's not about a destination. It is the journey. And mm-hmm. I think I'm like, I love that so much, because that's also how I think psychedelics helped me relate to life a lot more, is like, it wasn't like I want to be here and I'm not there, so I feel down about it. It's like, no, like I'm proactively living it and there is no end. And yeah, there's like a gratitude and appreciation that can, I believe, be accessed when you get to see life in that way. So yeah, definitely like the more you can do, the better. And as you know, and I'm sure many people listening know, it's not a straight line to healing. It's like up and down.
It's
and
2 steps forward, 1 step back. What about this? Because you made the comment about the person who, like, you just felt like you weren't equipped to help them, that they needed more one-on-one support. I'm wondering if, because this is being used in like studies where it's almost like the lost causes, right? Like the people, mm-hmm. but I'm almost wondering, like, is there a potential risk involved if there is a sense of urgency or desperation coming into the experience? But you would think that almost like for these studies that would kind of define maybe how some people are, but I'm just wondering, like if somebody feels like this real sense of urgency, I got to do this right now, or real like desperation, like is that potentially like a red flag that this could, you know, not be the right thing for that person right then and there?
Yeah. And it's hard to like, I think ultimately like it's a choice between the person and the facilitator, right? Like I always like want to be really clear with people. Like I'm not a gatekeeper to psychedelics, period. Still, even though there is this like research and legal renaissance going on, there's no doubt in my mind that 99.99% of people using psychedelics are not doing it in any of the ways that we're talking about using it today. And they're still getting benefits. And that's part of the reason it's being talked about more. And so, yeah, I think like, and ultimately, like people just need to have free choice and will in like their lives. And so most important is like, does someone feel like it's something they want to try, and they, do they find a safe way? And equally, like, does the facilitator feel like it's within their, you know, professional boundaries or qualifications to support that person? And I think it's, you know, good facilitators, or people that I would call good facilitators, would probably, if they don't work with someone, they would put a good amount of effort into finding someone who would be a better fit. Because you don't want to leave someone who's hopeless with less hope. Like, this was the one thing I thought, and now you're turning me down.
Yeah, no kidding. What about for somebody who's treating trauma, a complex trauma, or just like stuff from childhood, a full-on trip versus microdosing? Like, what are your thoughts there?
Yeah. So I'm a big proponent of both uses of psychedelics. I find that a lot of people don't really understand microdosing. And a lot of people like, well, they'll even say like, oh yeah, I heard Oregon made microdosing legal. Just like not the technically yes, but that's not what people are coming to Oregon to do.
Yeah.
The way I like to frame microdosing is it could be used as a really helpful, like longer term mood stabilizing agent. So just for people who don't know much about microdosing, it's generally taking a dose of a psychedelic, usually mushrooms or LSD, that is approximately 1/10 or less of a full dose. And there are a couple different common protocols, but one of them is every third day you would take a dose, and one of them is you would take it for 3 or 4 days in a row and then take 3 or 4 days off.
Oh, interesting.
And people will report feeling a little bit more creative, a little bit less depressed, a little bit more lighter. And there's a book that was written about, I'm going to like overly simplify this woman as a soccer mom. It's like kind of how she comes across in the book, but she wrote a book called A Really Good Day. And I like that title because what she says in the book is like, it's about her microdosing journey and it's mixed in with research and storytelling of psychedelics. So it's also educational, but she looked at the microdosing journey as like that feeling you have when you just get home and you're like, you can't necessarily name why, but like, oh, that was just a good day today. Her objective of microdosing was just having more of those days. If you like kept a journal for 30 days of your mood, you wouldn't necessarily know which days you microdosed and which days you didn't. But over the course of a couple months, you'd be able to start to feel like you have more good days. And so very different than a high dose psychedelic journey where you're much more likely to get very clear, direct insights and experiences around re-relating to traumatic experiences or feeling connections to things. Like, you can still feel this kind of stuff in microdosing, but you know, a lot of people microdose and still work and still, you know, like do their errands. And so, yeah, it's quite a different experience. And a lot of people I work with are very curious about microdosing after their bigger dose journeys. And I very much encourage that. And I don't tell people how to break the law explicitly, but there are so many online resources that do. So I point people in the right direction and then I'll give them tips and resources on how to microdose. But yeah, I think that like education is really important. Like, and the risk of microdosing generally is like, that I found, like, because you are taking such low doses, like you'll go through a phase of calibrating what's the right dose for you. For an example, like the dose I take for microdosing is larger than that my wife takes because she's more sensitive.
Mm-hmm.
Outside of that, and then the suggestion for that is to always start on a day where you don't have anything else to do, just in case it's a little bit too strong. Outside of that, a small amount of people sometimes, even though for some people it can help anxiety, some people feel like it makes them more anxious. Mm-hmm. I haven't really heard of any other real risks of microdosing. And then if it just makes you more anxious, you can just stop doing it, you know. But there is interesting research done by a famous mycologist named Paul Stamets. So if anyone researches psilocybin, they'll run into this guy very quickly. But he talks about how psilocybin microdosing in combination with lion's mane mushroom, a non-psychedelic mushroom, has been shown to regrow broken brain neurons. And so he talks about the high dose journeys being like the emotional therapeutic way to use psychedelics. And then microdosing like literally can help shift the structure of your brain to be more resilient and to be more like, and I think they've shown like sometimes traumas in your brain like can show up as like bent, you know, neurons and stuff. And it can really, it's kind of wild. There's not a lot of things we know that grow new brain cells after childhood, and psychedelics are one of them. It's just a really interesting, relatively unknown aspect of how they work.
That's crazy. Can you talk about your role like as a facilitator? And I know you mentioned that you had to do some sort of a certification like in Oregon, but like what has been your process in, I don't know, like learning how to do that role? And like, I mean, it's like you kind of started like from your very second time you were actively in it, but you know, you kind of started as a facilitator early, but like, is it, you know, like have there been moments like where you've been like really nervous or you haven't known what to do, or like, you know, what sort of guidance have you received around Like, what has been the most important things, I guess, that you've learned or experienced that have helped you in that role? And what makes a good facilitator?
Yeah, I can speak about this. I think it's important to know, like, I'm not, so I've been around this for a long time in a pretty active way. I was not a facilitator at the organization I started in Europe, but I do consider the amount that I worked with some very skilled facilitators. Some of them now are like seen as like, you know, some of the best educators in the field. I learned so much from working with them that, yeah, I'm just very grateful. So I guess like mentorship is like one of the, you know, most specific ways. And again, like always, I tell clients this too, like I'm not at this stage in my career, I'm not trained in any particular type of trauma treatment or, but you, when you're around it long enough and you understand the way the psychedelics work and how to help people approach them with compassion and curiosity and meet people where they're at and don't be judgmental. Like, you know, I just feel like there's fundamentals there that I picked up on and embodied over time. And I think something that intuitively I've had for myself at a very young age is just this, like, and it's been mirrored to me a lot throughout my life, that like people tend to feel very safe with me. Mm-hmm. And that I think is a really big asset to being a facilitator mm-hmm. in this work, because so much of what people energy. Come with.
Yeah.
And so much of what people come to their first experience with is a fear, because we're all dealing with 70 plus years of the war on drugs telling us mostly lies. And so
that was going to be my other, just so I'm just, let me say this out loud so I don't forget. Okay. That was going to be the other thing is like, as far as like, are most people really nervous like before? And is that okay? And can that be harmful to the journey if they are really nervous?
Yes, everyone is nervous. Even those of us who do it all the time are still nervous when we do it. Mm-hmm. And someone I recently worked with shared that it's like a healthy respect for the medicine or for mm-hmm. the unknown to have that level of nervousness. Of course, we try to work with people and, you know, it's probably impossible to call it down entirely, but, you know, through the act of preparing and doing workshops, and we work with stuff like breath work, which can be similarly powerful as a, like a precursor to taking psychedelics. So it helps ease them in. So there's lots of things that can be done, but yes, everyone is nervous, of course. And then I can touch a little bit on a specific licensure here in Oregon. So facilitators in Oregon have to go through a training program that is regulated by the state. It's only 150 hours of training. I think this is the most justified criticism of the model here in Oregon. And I understand why they set it up this way. So I can talk a little bit more. But in Oregon, you have no requirement to have any other mental health training at all to be a facilitator. Mm. And you only have to go through 150 hour training. And it's been pointed out that like massage therapists have to go through a much more intensive training in Oregon to get a license. So
what is covered in those 150 hours?
It's very fundamental. It's like some of the stuff we've talked about, but like safety, best practices, how to prepare, how to support. Oregon's model and law is very specifically non-directive. So they're really focused on teaching people to like, just again, like create this safe space to let the experience unfold. And there's even a lot of rules, like you're not allowed to, like you're not supposed to be helping someone direct their journey. And this comes from like best practices in the research and underground. So it's not unfounded. But I'd say like what I appreciate about the Oregon model is one, like just that it got passed and made into law is like mm-hmm. such a milestone in the world. And it does prevent the worst things from happening. So in the psychedelic underground,
yeah.
there are stories of people being sexually assaulted under, you know, by underground psychedelic therapists. And what a terrible thing, like in such a vulnerable state, someone does that. And then you broke the law. So you don't even want to tell anyone that happened because you were breaking the law to do it. And so, yeah, there's a lot of like really fundamental safety things that I think the Oregon model covers and mostly in the realm of physiological safety.
Does it touch upon trauma at all?
I'm trying to remember if there's any specific state requirement to touch on trauma. If there is, it's minimal for sure. Yeah. And just to say, like a lot of people in Oregon have lots of background in therapy or, you know, psychotherapy or somatic therapy. Like most people are coming to this work and adding on to their repertoire. There are also some people who like just had a couple trips and want to get their license. So I just tell people to really do your homework on your facilitators. I think there's 300 or so of us now in the state that are licensed. Probably about half of us are actively trying to use it. So do your homework, and also don't only rely on your homework. It's like, yeah, like I've heard of really like medical doctors with licensure who also are not very kind or very thoughtful people. So a little bit of homework, but mostly trust your gut. Like, do you feel safe with this person? Do they have references? Like,
yeah, and how much of an impact can that be? Like, I understand like they're on their own journey, but like,
yeah,
if somebody does come up against some really tough resistance or starts having a difficult time, like how much can a quality facilitator impact that experience? Can that be like a real game changer?
I'd say a lot. Like, yeah. I'd say like one spectrum of that is like, whether it's intentional or not, I'm sure it'd be mostly unintentional, like doing harm to that person in that experience. Like, mm-hmm. someone comes up from their journey and is talking about their trauma, and someone, a facilitator, is saying things like, oh no, that's not what that is. The, you know, mm-hmm. this is what it really means. Like, you know, like really, like that would be like, I would mm-hmm. consider that
very invalidating.
Yeah. And like borderlining harmful, you know, mm-hmm. could be. And then like, yeah. And then I'd say like in the best case scenario, like the small hand-holding gesture or the small statement that someone says, like, remind you to breathe through the resistance. Like, people will report that in their journeys, those can make the difference between like really feeling like in a tough space and like really something that transforms into something beautiful. So, yeah. So I think there's like a lot of truth to like, you know, like someone who's compassionate, has experience, grounded, like won't start freaking out if you start freaking out, right? Because that's not going to be helpful to your nervous system in that state. You know, there's a lot of ways that can be really helpful. And then when we do a lot of group work too. So like just creating a lot of boundaries and structure in a group. Group psychedelic work can be really powerful. And especially if the group is really well structured, and the ways like just like any other support group can enhance the experience of everyone else. But also if it's not held well and you have one person in a group that's freaking out and everyone else is like, what's going to happen? Is someone helping that person? Mm-hmm. Like, mm-hmm. you know, there's other ways it can transpire. So yeah, you get into these states that like sometimes small things can just magnify. One of the most famous psychedelic researchers calls psychedelics non-specific amplifiers of your subconscious. And so I use that language just because like, yeah, it's like something that's really small. Like how loud is the music or how easy is it to get a drink of water and go to the bathroom in your journey can become very emotionally draining and big. So like just the right person knows how to make you feel safe, most important, and then also support you through those tense moments.
Okay. Two more questions. Although I could have like a million bajillion, but last, I just want to make sure I cover this. The word integration gets thrown out. Like what the hell does that mean? I mean, you know, I think people are probably like, how specific is that? Like, what do we mean by like, this has to be followed up with integration work afterwards?
Mm-hmm. Do you want to get the other question out so we don't forget?
Well, the other thing I was just going to ask you was just if like, what are good resources that you think people should check out as it pertains to my audience?
Yeah, cool. I can do both that. So we've talked a lot about integration and I appreciate calling me out because I haven't used that word.
Right. Well, I mean, yeah. Well, I think it's come up, important. But I just want to like specifically like define it, which I'm sure it's very broad.
Integration generally is the act of taking the insights and lessons from your journey and integrating them into your life so that they are meaningful, lasting changes instead of things that you saw on a journey 6 or 12 months ago. And so what that looks like often is often with support, but you don't necessarily need support to do good integration work, is discovering what meaning what you experience has for you and how you want to start making shifts in your life towards embodying that meaning. So if you, I'm just going to spit out some random made up examples, but if you had an experience in your journey of having a lot of compassion to your parents of how, what stage of life they were in and what they were dealing with when they had you. And no wonder it was so messed up because look what they were dealing with at that time. Like you can have these like really powerful, empathetic moments, but like, how do you turn that into meaningful change in your life? Like, do you have some conversations you want to have with your parents if they're still around? Or do you want to, you know, look at how you're acting with your children and what might be, you know, what values or lessons you might be accidentally instilling in them, and maybe there's shifts you want to make in that dynamic. And so on a simpler level, like, are there healthier life habits that you want to make to shift? Like, I mean, starting meditation practice can be a really powerful one that is generally more available for people after the journey than before. You know, I always like ask people if they want to shift any patterns with technology or 24-hour news cycles, healthy eating, right? Like all these things. And it could be as simple as like, I want to go for more walks in nature throughout my week. Or it can be as specific as I want to
give up Candy Crush.
No, I would never suggest someone give up Candy Crush.
I haven't. Well, you would to me. Trust me.
Yeah, seriously, though, like these things have a lot of psychological implications. And so, yeah. And just how do you want to find more meaning and purpose in your life? And so, like people who use this, who work with psychedelics a lot will, and I say eventually when people start the journey of psychedelics, it helps them learn more that integration is just this lifelong thing that you're always doing inside and outside of psychedelics, but particularly around the psychedelics. And that's the real risk of, you asked earlier, like what's the risk of using them as an escape tool, which is possible. It's like that you're just not integrating what you're learning and I use this metaphor when we were chatting before the recording, but one metaphor for psychedelic use that I like is that they can like, it can give you that glimpse of being at the top of the mountain. And so you can have this like awe-inspiring feeling of you're at the top of the mountain. Look how beautiful it is. I feel connected to whatever, you know, universal nature there is in this existence, but you eventually come back down from the mountain. And so like, And with psychedelics, you haven't necessarily climbed to the top of the mountain. You just had the experience of being there for a little while. And so the risk is that you just keep going to the top of the mountain because you found this elevator tool and you're not actually taking what's there and starting to do the climbing yourself.
Yeah, climbing yourself. Yeah. I love that. Perfect answer. Okay. So what do you think would be good resources for people to check out if they're interested in exploring this more?
So there are a lot. There's a lot of psychedelic education websites. One that comes to mind is the Third Wave, great online resource for psychedelics. There are lots of people like myself now, especially in Oregon and Colorado, where there are legal models who are just like I do 45-minute calls with every prospect client that like largely is about talking to them about their intention and supporting them, but also like what might be the best way, you know, and timing to look at. I'm just going to spitball some websites off the top of my head. TripSafe is a really simple but online free resource for like, they have a few guides like how to do dosing and how to do, you know, how to be a sitter for your buddy if, you know, it's like, if that's a scenario you want to explore. And so, and then I'd say there's probably no Double Blind magazine is another online resource for psychedelics. It's a little bit more in the like, e-zine cultural category, but they do great articles and they have a lot of journalism going on. So yeah, those are probably simple ones. Like really, like these days I just feel like Google is like very quick to turn things up. Yeah, and there's so much good information because so many people are turning on to this nowadays. So things I'd watch out for.
Yes.
If anyone is like, yeah, just like if you stumble upon anyone who like is too certain about knowing too many things, like part of the nature of using psychedelics for me and many is like their revealing of how much we really don't know and how much is unknown. And so like, you know, just try to be mindful. You're not working with someone who is like,
they have all the answers.
Yeah. Thinks they have all the answers is, you know, maybe has narcissistic tendencies, makes you feel uncomfortable, like really trust your gut. There's no shortage of how you can approach this work now. So like, just cause someone spent an hour or 2 hours talking to you on the phone doesn't mean you have to work with them, you know, like truly like up until the time you, and this is even the law here in Oregon is like up until the time that you take the psychedelic, you don't have to do it. Like you can ask to change facilitators and you can ask to do this. So it's like, just, I think that's maybe something that people don't normally feel as empowered about in our world with the medical system and this like sense of authority that is inherent and people, you know, buy into at no fault of their own. But like, yeah, like you are in choice and you can decide to shift and it's very unlikely that you would regret trusting your gut on something like that.
Well, I just want to thank you for well, obviously for the interview, but just for like what you're doing and, you know, kind of, I'm sure you don't want to refer to yourself as this, but like being kind of a trailblazer for this sort of work here. And, you know, I'm sure you've already impacted, facilitated and helped, you know, huge changes in people's lives. And there's just, I think, endless potential for so much healing to occur. So I'm just really grateful, you know, for somebody like you who is genuinely like so passionate about it. And I can just tell, like, I can read people's energy. Like, you're really genuine about this. Like, I'm, you know, I just, it feels good to know that there's somebody out there that's like doing this, that seems to have the right intentions behind it, you know? So thank you so much for all that you're doing. And I think that this is just the beginning. You got big things ahead.
Yeah, thanks a lot. I don't know if you could tell, I was like twitching with how uncomfortable I was with how much you were complimenting me. Yeah, I appreciate it. And thanks
don't
for...
Don't kiss anyone's ass.
Yeah, and thanks for... I mean, thanks to you for helping use your platform. I mean, I think that's like... I feel like there's this wave happening anyway, and a big gap that I constantly see is good information. So that's really just my intention, is helping good information get to people who are like maybe on that next wave of people who are going to start turning to psychedelics. And yeah, love
to... I'll put all your shit in the show notes. This won't be the last time that we're talking. It won't be the last time that you're on the podcast, and really excited to see kind of what unfolds here. So, and hopefully we can get some people on that have been in your retreats.
I'm excited about that.
Don't let it all go.